This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. What would you like to get off your chest? Are you holding on to secrets, fears, or frustrations? We all carry around different stressors, both big and small. Don't keep it all bottled up inside. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest and work through whatever is weighing you down. It's also a great way to learn to resolve conflict, change negative thought patterns, and more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/BeHereNow today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/BeHereNow.
Welcome to Conda Mason's Brown Rice Hour, a podcast that quilts together a fabric of connection between land, race, money, culture, and spirit. Discover a connection that engages with the most inspiring and cutting-edge thought leaders today, pointing toward our collective healing and liberation. If you are interested in supporting the Brown Rice Hour, please visit BeHereNowNetwork.com/Conda.
So welcome, everyone. Thank you for joining us. This is the Brown Rice Hour, where I have conversations at the intersection of land, race, money, culture, and spirit. My name is Conda Mason, and I am very happy that you have joined us for this incredible podcast that we are going to explore with my special guest today, who is Mr. Paul Hocken. And I just want to, first of all, say thank you, Paul, for coming on this podcast.
An honor, a pleasure, a joy, really, totally.
So cool to have you here. Paul is, if you don't know Paul, which most of you probably do, but just so you know for sure, he is the founder of Project Drawdown, and he's so many things, and he's also the founder of Project Regeneration. He is a brilliant author of many, many books. He is an innovator. I see you, Paul, as the person who really, really is in the forefront of wellness, of like institutionalized business wellness. How do we make wellness something that is actually where people can find it? And starting with the Erewhon, starting the really first health food store.
Natural food store.
Yeah. And so many things that you have done that has been innovative and amazing. And so we're going to talk to Paul about his latest book, primarily, that is incredible and is necessary and is available right now today. And we're going to talk about that as it pertains to the climate crisis that that the world is in, and Paul's work is in the forefront of helping us think through, understand, and act and move forward. So before we get into all of this, though, Paul, I like to open up sacred space, okay? And I do that just by, one is honoring the ancestors on the land where we are both. I am in Louisiana now, and this is the Choctaw country, the unceded land of the Choctaw people who are still here. And in the parish that I particularly live in is Rapides Parish is where they are primarily still here, which is wonderful to know. I'm wondering where you're calling in from.
I'm on the unceded land of the coastal Miwok, who extended up the coast and then into the San Joaquin Valley as well. So that's an interesting way to begin, because oftentimes people say, what should I do? You know, what's the first thing? What's the most important
thing
to do about climate? And I say the most important thing is to find out where you live.
Mm. Land.
The land, the migratory birds, you know, the native plants, you know. In other words,
even if
it's paved over, you know, which in some cases it certainly is, but you don't know where you live. And when you find out where you live and what's going on there, that unless you're just in streets, you know, but if you're in anywhere proximate to country, to land, to forest, to prairie, to grasslands, to mountains, to rivers, to streams, to riparian corridors, to creeks, you know, anything like that. When you really find out where you live, you know, you discover you're living in a miracle. You're living in something that is so awesome, full of awe, you know, and wonder and delight and connections. And I just think we've lost that sense that, you know, I said, natural food instead of health food. The reason I started the store was because there were health food stores and they had vitamins and supplements and nostrums and, you know, women wearing white hosiery and look like nurses, you know, and I just felt like what I wanted to have a store that took you back to the life of the land. It brought you back to life.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
So we never sold vitamins and never sold pills, never sold supplements. We sold food.
Food as vitamins, food as nourishment.
Absolutely. I don't remember seeing any African American, Native Americans taking vitamins.
Right. In my calcium. Gosh. Paul, there's so much that I want to talk to you about, and there's so much richness that we can share on this podcast. I always begin talking about food, actually, and because it's called the Brown Rice Hour for a reason. Brown rice actually changed my life. I became what is known as a vegan now, but it's just someone who ate natural food and I got rid of, you know, a lot of the dairy products and the meat and all that stuff. It wasn't called anything then. And this was in 1975 is when I changed my diet because I could never breathe out of both nostrils at the same time. And I realized a guy that I knew, he said, you know, you could change that if you just stop doing dairy. And I was drinking milk constantly. So anyway, I changed that. I stopped that and meat. And lo and behold, I could breathe for the first time out of both nostrils since I was born.
Wow.
And I never looked back. And the stomach cramps that I always had eating also stopped. And I realized I was lactose intolerant. So that was a big thing for me. But then I did the macrobiotic thing for a while. And brown rice was, I loved rice. I was a white rice eater, right? And then when I discovered brown rice, it just changed everything. So, and now I'm growing rice. So I named this the Brown Rice Hour for many reasons. And I'm a foodie. I love food. I love natural food. And I'm always curious. I love the conversation to have about when I ask the question that I'm going to ask you, it actually, it can tell a lot about a person and kind of, it reveals, it's kind of revealing. So the question is, what was as a child, if you had one, did you have, and what was your comfort food and who prepared it? What was the food that made you feel safe in the world, comforted in the world, and who was it that prepared it?
Wow. Well, just to go back a little bit, I was the earliest recorded case of asthma in San Mateo County where I was born. So within a few months of being born, I had trouble breathing. And so I had asthma until I was 20, but the probably the food that the well, I remember several things. My mom came from a farming family, and it was very similar to when I was in the civil rights movement. The only safe place you could be in the South if you're a civil rights worker is with black families, either on the farm or in the city. But oftentimes it was in more rural conditions, you know. And I remember the food was fantastic, you know. And but it reminded me of my mom and my grandparents too, because, you know, everything we ate, we made, you know, we didn't open a can or something like that. And so I remember two things. One, strawberry shortcake, which was you make this these shortcakes, you know, and with flour and baking soda. It didn't have any sweetener in it, the shortcake, none, you know. It was just like a biscuit, like a flat mm-hmm. biscuit. And then we'd have fresh strawberries from the farm, you know, crushed with sugar, of course, you know. And then whipped cream we made from the cream from the cow, you know, that we had, you know. So we had whipped cream and strawberries and shortcake. That was like super special. Then we made ice cream. We handmade it with rock salt and one of those things you turned. And we kept taking turns at, you know, because it took a lot of muscle for a little kid, you know.
Those too.
Yeah. It was like, but it was so exciting, you know. It had frozen strawberry pieces in it, you know, and vanilla and of course cream and eggs and, you know, so those are things. And then the other thing that I remember from my mom is she called it tamale pie. I don't know what it was, but I remember it had corn and beans and it was just like a melange really of things. And so those are the foods I remember.
Where were you again?
Where
were you located at that time?
At that time we were located in Walnut Creek, but my grandparents lived near Oakdale in the valley, and that's where their farm was. They were almond farmers. If you said almond, the people knew you weren't from there.
Almond.
Almonds. I think we're almonds. But the thing is that, you know, I had asthma all my life. And by the time I was a teen, I was taking three times the maximum daily dose of aminophylline ephedrine, which is kind of like a mild stimulant, methadrine, really. I mean, it's like a three times a daily dose to keep breathing. You know, and I had three different doctors, you know, prescribing, because I had to get three prescriptions to make sure I had enough. And I read a book when I was 20 that said, if you're sick, it's your fault. And it really pissed me off because I had asthma from five, six months old, you know. And it's like, and at the same time, it said, basically, if you're sick, it's your responsibility, you know. And that took, in other words, because the doctors hadn't done squat for me since I was born.
Wow.
And so I started a food fast, which is brown rice for 10 days and tea. And for the first time in my life, I could breathe without medicine.
This is crazy. That's crazy.
No, that's true. You know, that's what started Erwan. That's what started Erwan. It's like I'm going,
Erwan.
Holy smokes. And so at first, Conda, I was like, wait a minute, I don't want to be a food faddist. That's what they were called then. You know, people who didn't eat, you know, hamburgers and milkshakes and all that sort of stuff. And I like my hamburgers. I like my milkshakes. I like my beer. You know, I like whatever, you know. And I thought, whoa. It's that simple after 19 years of American medical establishment, administrations, you know, and pills and this. And I mean, I remember one time the doctor saying, you know, asthma is really caused by issues with your mother. You know, I'm going,
oh gosh.
I just said, look, at anybody in the world would have issues with my mother. And so don't give me that. And you're darn right I have issues with my mother, but that ain't it. You know, but anyway, I started because I was on a food fast, then I would drink a beer. I go, whoa, look what that did to the part of the brain, alcohol, the part of the brain that controls the lungs, you know. Yep. Well, push that away because you feel it so strongly, you know. And then same with, I just try all different foods, you know. And I felt like for the first time in my life, I could actually experience what the food did.
Yeah.
Because when you're eating a lot, you know, a whole mixture of food every day, and it changes and, you know, it's just, and whether you feel good or not,
yeah,
you can't feel the specific effects or impacts of that food. And so I was stubborn, and I when I kept trying things, I got, all right, okay. And what happens is, like, to buy, my business partner, Calliope Company, Bill, and I lived in the warehouse down in Tenderloin, you know, so he started too. He weighed 230-240 pounds, and he lost 80 pounds like that, you know.
Wow.
He went on the diet too. And, but we had to go to Japantown, Chinatown, Lebanese town, we called it, wasn't really, to the mission, to the Seventh-day Adventist mill and the farmer's market on a Saturday to get everything we needed for that week. There's no place we could go to shop. And so everyone was like, gosh, you know, if I figure this out, other people are going to figure this one out. So everyone was really like a farm stand, you know, in the city. It was like the foods, you know, we didn't sell dairy, of course. But
and what year was that, Paul, that you started Erewhon?
Oh, that was 1966.
66. In Boston.
Yeah, Boston first, yeah. And then LA, yeah.
In Boston, and then LA, which became nowhere. They reversed it, right?
No, I stayed Erewhon.
I stayed Erewhon, okay.
Oh, yeah. It's really, it's now it's like the most expensive store in LA, and everybody jokes about it. I mean, you can just sit there and look at all the, you know, celebrities coming in and out, the influencers, you know, I mean, it's crazy. Yeah. So that's not what we had in mind. We had in mind just connecting people to food, but it's the DNA of Erewhon is still there. No question about it. And quality. Yeah.
So there was just the one, in LA, because when I used to live in LA, and that's where I shopped. So when I changed my diet to in 75, like I said, I was in the Bay Area, I was in Berkeley, and there were no health food, natural food stores at all. There was a co-op.
There's a co-op, Berkeley co-op.
Yeah, co-op, and everything's in a vat, right? There was very little prepackaged food at all. And you've got all your stuff in bulk. And that's how we lived, and that's how we ate, and it totally changed my life too. And really realizing, it's so interesting that you had the breathing thing from asthma. I had the breathing thing from the dairy, and I don't know if you're familiar with the guy Arnold Arendt.
Oh, yeah.
He had the mucusless diet healing system, and that's what I did, and it just changed my life, and I never looked back, and I haven't looked back since then.
Yeah,
it's
why would you?
Exactly. So I entered this whole conversation just from a body that wasn't well, and finding wellness through food.
Somebody said to me at one point, like, "Well, how's your diet going?" I said, "I'm not on a diet. You are."
Right.
I eat everything I want to eat. Your taste buds have been hacked by big food.
Yeah. Oh, God.
And you're the one that's on a diet that's been designed by food chemists who know that salt, sugar, and fat instinctively wanted by the human body because they were so scarce, you know, for hundreds of thousands of years and so forth, you know. So I never think of myself on a diet. I want to eat everything.
I totally am not on a diet, and yet I eat exactly what I want. And what I want are the things that make me feel good.
Yeah,
that's what I want, right? And people say, "Don't you miss eating meat, or don't you miss eating this or that?" I go, "For me, it's meat, and for me, it's dairy. That's just me. I'm not someone who says everybody. This is Conda Mason, this is how I have to eat to be healthy. And when I do eat well, I don't miss anything that I don't.
Why would you miss something that makes you feel bad?
Yeah, it's not my palate anymore at all, because it's been many years. So just really happy that I, you know, had this person help me find my way. And so then all other things change too, right? A lot of other things go with that. A lot of things go with that. So I just want to talk about, you know, Paul, you have been in my life for a while, and I have so enjoyed our friendship. And I was just right before I started this with you, and I was, you know, getting my little face together and what have you. And I thought, wow, he used to be my hair guy, too. Remember that?
Well, my wife's company, yeah.
Exactly.
Not me.
Not you, but yeah, but we spent some time in the chair.
yeah, we did. But that was for John Werner, who is the founder of Green Chemistry, and who wanted to get rid of hair dyes completely because they're so toxic and poisonous. You
know? They are so toxic and poisonous. Yeah. But I've done so many wonderful things, and so the book Drawdown was the latest that when you were really bringing forth and so much information, and now with the latest book, Regeneration, Ending the Climate Crisis in One Generation, I'm really curious, Paul, between those two books, what changed within you? And what changed on the macro level between those two books for you to write this next book?
Well, things did change for me, but Regeneration, I had decided to write as a sequel before I had finished Drawdown.
Okay. So it
wasn't like after the fact, but I mean, things did change as well, you know, in terms of how in 4 years, in 4 years, a lot changes for everybody. Drawdown started in 2001, really, for me, and that was when the third assessment of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change was released. And like each successive, you know, assessment, it's more dire, more pessimistic, more cautionary, more, you know, in its statements, you know, than the prior assessment. And that is because the science improved, the forecasting improved. Mm-hmm. And so you had to kind of parse it, you know, read between the lines, because it was put out as consensus science. Okay. Well, there's no such thing as consensus science. Science is evidentiary.
Right.
And it's never fixed. It's always changing. I mean, there are certain laws like the, you know, first and second law of thermodynamics that are different than science because they're, until disproven, they're a law of the, you know, phenomenon. Mm-hmm. But science itself, you know, is a learning, a constant iterative learning process and so forth. So, and so what it meant by consensus was that, you know, Russia, USSR, you know, then Russia later, but Saudi Arabia, Venezuela, you know, US, China, you know, OPEC countries, coal countries, then actually wouldn't release it unless they tamped down the summary report and the findings. And so that was consensus science. It was actually politics. Yeah. And so when you read it, you had to kind of read between the lines as to what the scientists underneath that who were doing the real work were really wanted to convey to the world. And at that time, what I noticed, Kanda, was that I wanted to know what to do. Mm-hmm. And the other thing I wanted was to name the goal. And at that time, as now, what people kept saying was talking about fighting and tackling and combating, you know, climate change and or mitigating was a popular word, too, still is, you know, conquering. I mean, it was crazy. And you could just guess which gender those words came from, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, these war and sports metaphors were being used as if the climate was in it out there somewhere that we could fight, tackle, combat, or, you know, conquer. And to me, verbs are not goals. And so I wanted a goal. I wanted to name the goal. And the only goal that made sense to me was not to combat it or, you know, fight it or even net zero, which is what Princeton was saying at that time in 2001, the Carbon Mitigation Project, was to reverse it. I mean, let's set the goal, everyone. That's what we want. We want to reverse what we've done. Mm-hmm. And that we want to bring that carbon back home that we've put up there because it belongs here in the biosphere. Right. And I went around basically asking people I knew, do we have a list of, you know, the climate solutions? No, I knew we didn't. I was a journalist. I looked for them, but can we make one? Can we map, measure, and model the most substantive solutions to reversing global warming? And it was known then, as it is now, that 2050 was sort of a threshold date in terms of achieving net zero. That is, by that time or before, we should be really bringing carbon back home. We should be not only not emitting, but we should actually starting to reduce the amount of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. And I talked to lots of, not lots, but many NGOs and friends, you know, institutions, universities, and so forth about that. And I always got nods, like, good idea. We don't do that, or we don't know how to do that, or we're not funded to do that. And, you know, fair enough. And they said, why don't you do it? And I said, that's why I'm asking you, because I don't know how to do it. And, but I want to have it. I want to see it. I want to understand that. And after a few years, I just stopped doing that because there was no uptake, which sort of confused me. And at that time, you know, and really right up until when the book was published, 2017, April, that if you Google the top solutions to global warming, you got eat smart, you know, whatever that meant. I mean, move closer to work, change your car, wash in cold water. This is a union of concerned scientists that put a power strip in your home entertainment center. No, I'm not kidding. It's like, really?
Wow.
I rhetorically said in speeches, well, what if you don't have a home entertainment center? Should you get one to put your power strip in? I mean, and these were just sort of proverbial things. You should say, pet your dog and love your mother too. I mean, yeah, eat smart, of course, you know, I mean,
right.
It was bizarre to me that the greatest crisis civilization has ever faced and may ever there wasn't a list of solutions. And the only solutions about forests was stop doing it, stop cutting it. Yes, good idea. There was nothing about farming whatsoever. There was nothing about food. There was nothing about the fact that 82% of the biodiversity is on the land of 4 to 5% of the population, aka indigenous people. In other words, and that is not a coincidence, you know. There was nothing about protecting human rights. There was, I mean, I could go on and on. There's nothing about women. There was no gender. There was nothing. I mean, it was so weird. And again, I think it came from science, and it was very male dominated climate science, you know, even though the first person to really discover that CO2 was the primary CO2 gas was Eunice Newton Foote in 1856 in America, you know. And although she was an amateur scientist and her work wasn't fully published until later, so other men took credit for that discovery, but she was the first one to discover it. So
interesting. When I saw her in the book, I actually looked her up to see.
Yeah.
Yeah. I hadn't heard of her. And I just.
Exactly. Well, know, that's not the first woman we haven't heard of who actually did the thing that other men took credit for, you know?
Yeah.
But anyway, it just like, it was in 2013, and Bill McKibben wrote that piece, Global Warming, Terrifying New Math. And what he did kind of was basically Mark Campanile, who started Carbon Tracker in London, had measured, looked at the balance sheet of every coal, gas, and oil company and in the world to get his hands on and to see what their assets were. That is, you know, and their assets, of course, were the reserves, the coal reserves, the gas reserves, the oil reserves.
Right.
And he added them up, you know, like in terms of, you know, carbon dioxide, you know, or carbon really. And said, if we burn that, we're Venus. So how can you call this an asset? How can you call this a financial asset? I mean, it's not, you know, and he called the bluff of these companies that was sort of overlooked for quite a while until recently. But what Bill did in 2013 is set a match to it. So he just burned it. And it was terrifying. It was horrible. And people came to me and said, oh my God, it's game over, you know, and you know, really had been so effective as environmentalists, as climate activists, and you know, I'm going to move to BC, take my kids, you know, get a farm or whatever. I mean, and I just felt that the game over is sometimes, especially in AA, although I've never been an addict. My addiction is workaholism and writing, but I've never been addicted to substances. But even though we're all addicted in some way. And so in AA, you know, there's this belief that when you surrender, that is when you, mm-hmm. you know, whether it's to a monotheistic God or not, the fact is you surrender. I don't know. I give up. I'm out of control. You know, and so forth. It's really a point of transformation. That's, you reach that point of transformation. So I thought that Bill's piece was actually more like a opening to game on as opposed mm-hmm. to game over. Mm-hmm. So I gathered people in who didn't know how to do it either, by the way, Amanda Ravenhill and Chad Fishman.
Oh yeah.
And you know, and we created an organization and we got maybe 200 people, researchers from all over the world, young researchers, postdocs and you know, in universities from 6 continents and 20 some odd countries and advisors. And, you know, I mean, I wrote the book, but, you know, but the research and it was informed by a we, and I felt like we need to talk to we, you know, us had to talk to us rather than somebody saying, I know you don't listen up. And I wanted to have it like, this is what we know. This is what we can do. This is what it'll cost. This is what the impact it'll be if these solutions scale continuously, you know, in a rigorous but reasonable way until 2050. And could we then, in our models, achieve drawdown by 2050? And we found out actually that we couldn't, by the way. And so, and then in the back of the book, we have two other scenarios where I say, okay, at the present rate, you know, we won't. If these solutions are scaling, but they have to scale faster in particular areas in order to do that. So that was drawdown.
Right.
So it's a long explanation, but yeah.
And drawdown.
Regeneration.
Yeah, now you're regeneration, you know, and...
Yeah.
Think about the difference between the words, Paul. It reminds me, I think about drawdown. Drawdown feels to me, I mean, it's like, it's this verb that feels like someone else can do that, like someone else needs to do that. I don't feel like I can do that. Regeneration feels like a state of being. Oh, I can do that.
That's exactly right.
Very
nailed it.
Feeling to them. Right. And books are exactly that difference too. You know, the state of being that I am already. And yeah, and so you you point that out so beautifully in the book of what regeneration is. I mean, I want you to state the definition of regeneration, and not just definition, but it's wholeness of what it is and who we are and how we are already that.
Well, exactly. I mean, the thing is that, you know, you go back to the climate science, and it was about future existential threat, which is a fear-based. True, by the way, but invokes fear, of course. I mean, and then activists took those science and started blaming and shaming and, you know, guilt tripping, and which yeah. was accurate as well in terms of who was being pointed out. So science and activists got it right. Yeah. But then you have somebody who isn't, in, say, an activist or a scientist, and then you have fear, threat, blame, shame, and guilt, you know, all mixed together. And then with these imperatives about what you should do, and if you don't do it, you're not really, you know, all this stuff basically is a good way to numb people. And just like, I have a mortgage, I have children, my mom's not, you know, has, you know, beginning of onset of Alzheimer's, you know, people have issues, they have problems, they have lives, you know, and so forth. So, you know, the way we were talking about it was so disengaging. And and the result of that kind of is that 98 to 99% of the world to this day is totally disengaged from doing anything.
98% of the world is disengaged.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's crises, the biggest crises of our planetary time.
Right.
90% are disengaged. And people know. It's not like they don't know.
They know. Half of them know. More than half know. They get it. They're even sympathetic. And they don't do anything. So the question in my mind wasn't to blame people. They've been blamed enough. Wasn't to blame, which is to, I mean, to look at the language, to look at the communication, to look at what do we do or what are we doing that absolutely continues to disenfranchise or disengage. So, you know, and I say like a climate denier and somebody who understands and does nothing is the same thing from the Earth's point of view. It doesn't make any difference what you believe.
Right.
If you don't do anything.
Non-action is non-action. Yeah.
Exactly. You know, and so I just feel like with Drawdown, it was from the literature, the scientific literature. It did name a goal. You know, that first time, you know, where greenhouse gases peak and go down on a year-to-year basis. But so Drawdown was a what to do, what we could do. That was what could be done book, you know, and here's the list. And it had never been seen before. Nobody, there was no list like it.
Right.
Regeneration is not what we can do. It's how to do it.
Yeah.
It's
yeah,
how we can do it.
Yes, we are. What it's to me when I think of regeneration and how you use it, it's so intimate. Drawdown is not intimate. It's like these things can be done. Regeneration is very intimate.
Yeah.
It's who I am already, and what is happening in this body right now is regenerating, right? Cells are regenerating, regeneration. And so words are so important. As you said, words are so important. Either you feel them and you connect with them or it feels like it's out there somewhere. And I think that you're right, that a lot of why there is no engagement or so little engagement, so little inaction, is that people have not been able to make it personal.
Exactly. The word is really important because all human beings, all living forms are innately regenerative. It's what life does. And as you mentioned, it's what our, you know, 30 trillion cells do every nanosecond. I mean, we regenerate, or we wouldn't be having this conversation right now. And so the reason I chose the word is because it is already what we do and who we are, as opposed to out there somewhere, our conceptual word, you know, that we should do. Even sustainability was completely conceptual. Like,
yes, conceptual.
What do you define that? What do you mean? Oh, okay, maybe. But we are regenerative. And when the way we take care of ourselves, and I know many people don't, but they don't understand, you know, what they should be doing, but they actually do take care of themselves in as much as they can, you know, and understand. We take care of our children. We take care of creatures around us. We take care of our environment. We take care of other people. We go to churches and mosques and synagogues and temples. All that prayer, all that devotion, all that is about transcendently about care, about love, about kindness, about compassion, about seeing the other as not as other. And so, you know, you look at the world and it's practicing regeneration every day. Now, do we have an economic system that is doing the opposite? Absolutely, of course. But so to me, it felt like, yeah, we have this extractive system. We've been born into it. Every economic sector or service that we receive or products we buy, if we pull the spring on the flower bag and look at the supply chain, it doesn't go very far before you see it's damaging life, harming life, taking life, killing life.
Yeah.
You know, forests, cultures, people, land, soil, fish, oceans. You just go down the list. Every single one of them is being damaged by our economic sector. Yeah. And so that is the road to generation. And what's happened, I think, especially this year, but in prior years as well, is that we can begin to see now, if we look down that road, we see the end of the road, as opposed, oh, let's just keep going. No, we can't keep going. I mean, Hurricane Ida and the droughts and the derechos and the cyclonic disturbances and the, you know, torrential rainfalls and the rising sea levels. And, you know, I mean, this goes, the drought, the migrations, you know, the famines, you know, all these things relate directly to climate change or are amplified by it, by global warming. And so the book suggests that we do a 180 and just that we're stealing the future from even ourselves now, but from our children and their children's children and all future generations. We're being really, really bad ancestors to the future. And I mean, one of the things is the hallmark of indigenous people, and I count African Americans as indigenous people, by the way. When I say indigenous people, it's like African Americans are different. No. Indigenous people that got enslaved and taken away from their ancestral homes, so they're still indigenous. But in indigenous cultures, you know, I mean, the idea that you were not acting in the best interest of the future was anathema. Of course you did. I mean, I listened to Hindu Omaru Ibrahim, the Chadian pastoralist, you know, and the other day, and she was talking about what we've heard before from the Iroquois Confederation, the idea of, you know, seven generations ahead, you know. But what she was saying, she said the same thing, but she said, we plan for seven generations ahead. We acted for the seventh generation because we knew the last seven generations. We actually knew what happened seven generations in the past. And so you could see yourself as part of this beautiful continuity. And I think there was a cultural, you know, unspoken but tacit understanding, you know, that people didn't even have to enunciate, that if you were acting out of that, in other words, you weren't acting within that blessing, but also responsibility to be that continuity to the seventh generations ahead of you, you were ostracized. You were like, well, what happened to her or him? You know, I mean, that person's, you know, and they would literally ostracize you from your culture, from your tribe, from your village, from your, you know, it's like, no, you don't belong here, you know, because that's what's, and that's, you know, so we being the settlers and colonists, you know, have a very different way of looking at the world. And what we're taught was completely the opposite. And it's very much about, you know, techno-optimists, you know, basically material, you know, do everything for yourself kind of economy and get as rich as you can because, it's a world that's very insecure and volatile and you better take care of yourself first. Otherwise, you won't be taken care of.
Right. The world is a dangerous place. And
it's a dangerous place and all that sort of stuff.
Not a friendly universe.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So we act that out.
We totally, yeah.
We act it out and we have the world. And so then you have this thing of where, you know, languaging, when you say fight, combat, tackle, all that sort of stuff, you're othering the climate. You're othering it. Same what we did to women. It's racism. It's Islamophobia. It's anti-Semitism. You know, it's like, othering, we are othering everything. And if you other it, like Bill Gates, I'm fixing it, what's it? There's no it there. And so to not understand, you know, bring it back to regeneration, the atmosphere and the biosphere are the same thing. One is solid, one more gaseous, but so are we, you know, we're solid and we breathe in and out gases, right?
Right.
So when is a gas a human and when is it not? And when is, you know, like,
right.
They're inseparable. So I just feel like regeneration is the default mode of life and we are life. And so what does it mean to heal the future instead of steal the future? What would that mean? Well, let's figure it out. And I think people are, by the way, it's not us, you know, regeneration of the staff, you know, but I think people are figuring that out, which is putting, and I define it as putting life at the center of every act and decision. That's what life does, you know. And so the fact that I have to make a sentence out of it is okay. And people can define it differently and probably more eloquently, but I want to make it simple. So every process, every act, everything we do, we simply ask that question, and we can't get back to regenerative society and culture and economies overnight, but we can begin to ask those questions.
I love it. And, you know, what I think about is when I think about all that's at bay and the crises, and when I think about regeneration and how you bring it forth, for me, because even, okay, so the word regeneration, I get it. I say the word is in my vocabulary. It's not in everybody's vocabulary.
No.
And the word that is in everyone's vocabulary that it reminds me of is relationship. And I think about my relationship with myself, right? My relationship with others, with you, with the planet, with other species, that the relationships, you said something about that the healing comes in a system when it, what was the word, when it's closest to itself?
No, the way you heal a system is to connect more of it to itself.
Connect more of it to itself. I love that. The way to heal a system is to connect more of it to itself.
Mm-hmm.
And that, for me, again, becomes the relationship. It's relational. And I feel that. And that's what has happened. It's like I see just these disconnections. And that is at the core. And so what this book is giving, in my estimation, you know, usually it's a book about carbon is at the problem. You're suggesting and saying that is not what is at the core. That is the result of what is at the core. That is the result, this carbon emissions that is killing us and all that we are doing. In addition to carbon, there's so many other things. I mean, it's a complex system, but that all those things are the result of at the core is this absence of connection.
Absolutely. The very core of the climate crisis is a profound disconnection between people.
Yep.
Which is wholly evident everywhere.
Yep.
The disconnection between people and nature.
Yep.
And then the way we've actually disconnected nature from itself through habitat fragmentation, poisoning, clear cutting, acidification of oceans, global fishing fleets, you know, hoovering out. I mean, so we've fragmented nature and disconnected it. We have fragmented our relationships to each other.
Yeah.
And we've created industries like Facebook and others that are extractive.
Yep.
These are extractive industries as well that amplify our differences instead of our what we agree upon and what holds us in common. And then we've educated ourselves and our children in places and in schools that are basically based on industrial models.
Mm-hmm.
To make workers,
mm-hmm.
for machines, that is companies, whether it's accountants or lawyers, whether it's, you know, journeymen, mechanics, you know, I mean, whether it's, you know, manufacturing jobs or whether it's, you know, in Amazon, you know, packaging boxes all day long, you know, as fast as you can. I mean, we're educating people away from a sense of the living world and their connection to it. And so, of course, we then get the outcome is activities that, again, you know, see life as something that is other. And we talk about that way in the climate movement, which is so silly. And then, as you so perfectly pointed out, the carbon is increased carbon, releasing carbon from the biosphere, whether it's old carbon like coal, gas, and oil, or new carbon from deforestation, or industrial agriculture, or the wiping out of wetlands, is basically the outcome of our activity. And conversely, I think that when people talk about in regenerative agriculture, you know, and they speak about it in terms of carbon, you know, I think, you're still missing the point. Yes, no question about it.
Right.
When you farm that way, carbon is sequestered and you have more carbon in the soil. But what you have more in the soil is not more carbon, you have more life.
That's right.
And the carbon, life is a carbon-based form.
And the farmers have more life. The farmers get to have more life.
Absolutely. But there's so many outcomes, you know, before you get the carbon that you would want to do regenerative ag. Probably I'd say the most important one is water itself, which is, you know, farms that have changed from industrial ag to regenerative agriculture can hold 10, 20, 30 times more water in terms of the rate of infiltration from rainstorms, thunderstorms, you know. And then it's there in the soil. So the soil is a reservoir. Yeah. We have desiccated the earth. We've desiccated in our farms and our deforestation in overgrazing and the way we've managed our grasslands and so forth. We've lost all this water. The earth is just like a person who, you know, is, you know, in a hot area, whether it's an athlete or somebody running in a Death Valley. At a certain point, if you desiccate, you die.
Right.
your body just can't, you know. And so we've desiccated the earth, and what Regen Ag and regenerative grazing does too, I might add, is bring the earth back to life, and that brings us back to life. And it brings it back to life by bringing water back to life, because water is also the other component of life. And so, but as you said, it's then you bring the food, there's more nutrient density, the food is healthier, whether you feed it to yourself or whether you feed it to an animal. The farmer's family, she or he is more healthy, and their children are more healthy.
Yeah.
The riparian corridors are more healthy. There isn't, you know, phosphates and nitrogen and nitrates going down the Mississippi, the Missouri and Mississippi, all the way causing the dead zone in the Gulf. I mean, the pollinators come back, and mixed pollinators, you know, the wild bees come back, not just the Italian bees, you know. I mean, it comes back. And what's in the book also is a few things like Isabella Tree, the wilding chapter, and there's a whole section of wilding. But the rate at which the earth recovers and regenerates is astonishing. It's astonishing. And as I said, I mean, basically we're being homeschooled now by the earth, by the planet. The planet's homeschooling us. We're the students. and lesson plan number one is to get in alignment with biology or life. And that's lesson number one. Do that. If you don't, the feedback that's coming is going to amplify and increase, and to the point where it's already causing suffering, and there'll be more and more suffering. But it's not, the climate isn't doing it to us. You know, we're changing the biosphere. That's causing global warming.
And it's like every system that we have is built in an extractive manner. It's built in a way of, you know, going back even to the people, the planet, it's all one connected ecosystem that we have so separated, as we've been talking about, right? Everything is so separate, and it's not. If it were, we wouldn't be actually here, actually. And I go back to, I love Thich Nhat Hanh's Inter-Be, that whole concept of us being a part of all things, but it's all the systems that we've created, all the systems. When I think about the social systems, when I think about the financial system, oh my God, we in the financial system is absolutely, the stock market is paying people dividends and returns on destroying the planet. It's like, I get more money to destroy the planet. And there are so few folks really paying attention to that. And even if they are, they turn a blind eye because the money is so sweet, you know? And what this whole concept of money and is on this agreement that we have about this thing that has created so much. I mean, there's money is not good, it's not bad, it's nothing. It has no inherent value. It's whatever we have given it, but we have given it so much power. And it's
Absolutely. Being used in ways that has just pilfered everything and each other for the money. So there's so many parts to this. And when I think about climate and the crises and the global warming and this impending disaster that we are creating, what I love about Regeneration, the book, is you have connected all the dots, Paul. You've connected all the dots. And there's no way anybody could read that and not get that how I live my life makes a big difference. And then in the end, there's just chapter on what to do, the question, what to do, right? Is there's, and then leading to the website, which the website is brilliant. Loving the website. I'm just getting deeper and deeper into it. So I just feel like when I look at how we have lived and how we live with each other and without each other and the separation and the indigeneity that has been so demeaned, so thrown away with this other mindset of separation, of hierarchy. Along with separation comes the hierarchy. Now, those two things together are just lethal because it's this hierarchy of who's on top, the humans on top, first of all, of every other being on the planet and the planet herself. And then within us, the stratification, the hierarchy. And what that has done. And so I know that it involves relationship. It's going to take all of us. It involves connection, involves all of that. And that brings me to truth and reconciliation. Because how are we to come together when we haven't told the truth? When we haven't really told the truth about what has happened here? It was the Southern Poverty Law Center, I think it was, that did a survey and found out that it's something like 80% of high school students were told that the Civil War had nothing to do with slavery.
With slavery, I know.
Nothing to do with slavery. It's states' rights. And so the truth hasn't been told. And yet it's time that we have to figure out bridging and bonding. We've got to figure out how to bridge without the truth, without reconciliation. And that is where I get stopped. That is where I think, how do we do that? Because what I'm seeing right now, even in terms of like the land back movement, is really, it's nascent, but it's happening. It's picking up. The land back movement is so important. When I think about reparations, I mean, it's not until now that I even hear the word reparations coming out of mouths of people that you see on television and not just, you know, us in little circles. There's something going on. There is something that is moving forward and it requires truth telling. It requires this discomfort, what is been looked at and called, even in, you know, the book of Robin DiAngelo, when she talks about white fragility, when we talk about, it's going to cause this discomfort that people have to be willing to sit in and to be a part of. And in order for us to come together to do this, because it's like everybody is needed. Everybody's needed. No one's doing this alone. How do we bridge and bond when so much harm and lies are the name of the game and separating us more?
Yeah, of course. In some ways, I mean, that's a call.
I don't expect you to have the answer.
Yeah, I was going to say, I was going to call it a Wizard of Oz question. Like, whoa.
No.
That's
out there for me that I'm...
No, I know. This is the way I see it. And I agree with everything you've said. The the climate movement in the most amorphous sense of the word, that is to say organizations, NGOs, churches, whatever, people groups, networks that are actively addressing it through their actions, not, and we mentioned this already, you could do something and it, the outcome is reversing warming. That's not your purpose. Your purpose is, you know, to restore the integrity and the financial viability of farmers, their soil, the food, you know, okay. And that one of those outcomes is reversing global warming. But the climate movement is going to become the biggest movement on Earth because of one reason, because of weather. And so what's happened is that it's been very conceptual for people. That is, it's science and acronyms and metrics and jargon and, you know, do not change people. They don't change their beliefs. They don't change their attitude. They don't change what they do. What changes people is experience. Now, I'm sure science wishes that all their predictions from the past, which have come true, you know, would have changed people sooner or earlier. And perhaps if we didn't have a corrupt socio-political system, maybe that would have happened. I don't know.
Right.
Maybe, maybe not. But I do know that what we are doing right now in our sundry ways, in various ways, we are rehearsing the future. That is, we're working on the solutions that become more relevant, trenchant, and obvious and imperative in the future. No question about it. The question is, do we have enough time? Is just put it aside, because there's all the time in the world. Time is never ends. Do we have enough time? I don't know. You know, that's another question, you know, but we have time to do what we do well and do what we do best, which is to come together. And I guess go back to a childhood thing, which is which sandbox you want to play in, the ones where they're fighting or having a good time. Mm-hmm. And I see regeneration as actually a joyous thing, as a celebratory thing, as a thing that brings people together. And I know some, like Adam Chappell, I know farmers who are deeply conservative, you know, and they will swear by not by industrial ag, but by regenerative ag now, because it took them out of bankruptcy, you know, or near bankruptcy, you know, and they'll just say it. What's the difference? Profit. Then I can make a profit again. You know, I couldn't going where I was going.
Family.
And so I think climate is bringing us together in ways that where what divides us is far, far less important than what unites us and so forth. And I think it's incumbent upon all of us to do the most important thing about having a conversation, which is to listen compassionately and actively to others who you don't understand or agree with. But the other thing about it is that Nexus is the part of the website. It's that is about how to's. It is the most complete, it's not finished yet, it will be, but the most complete listing and network of climate solutions and how to get them done in the world, all right? Has all the ones in drawdown, has the ones in regeneration, has others. I mean, like food apartheid wasn't in either one. It's there in Nexus, for example.
I love it.
And so there's other things in it that don't show up in anybody's climate list. They have to be there.
Yeah.
A lot of them about justice and equity and so forth are there that aren't their challenges and solutions, but you know, they don't neatly fall into one or the other. They're there. But if you look at the list and you think about it, and if we didn't understand global warming, if we did not understand climatology, if we had no clue as to what was causing extreme weather like Hurricane Ida, you know, for example, just like, oh, wow, that was a bummer. That was a really, really big hurricane. Yeah, it really was. Biggest I've ever seen. Oh, yeah. I mean, if we didn't understand the amplification the warming of the Gulf causing, you know, amplification of the hurricanes and the force that they hit us with in Louisiana particularly, we would want to do every single solution in Nexus.
Mm-hmm.
Of the cascading benefits they have.
Yeah.
For children, for water, for meaningful jobs, you know, for health, for education, for the transformation of our cities, you know, for biodiversity, for pollinators, for clean air, for clean water. I mean, for fisheries, for, they all make sense, you know, from a sensibility that doesn't depend on a way of seeing the world that doesn't understand climate or doesn't understand global warming. It's okay.
Yeah.
And so, I know many regen ag farmers, you know, who basically they became regen ag farmers because they hit the wall. Yeah. And they did not do it because of global warming. In fact, they were naysayers. They either didn't believe it or just said, you know, and they called it a belief system. You know, I don't believe it. And as if science was a belief system, it's not. But now that they're doing it and they're getting paid for, they're starting to get paid. You know, getting checks for sequestering carbon. They're actually looking at it the way they should, which is actually there's more opportunity going ahead in healing the future than stealing the future. Yes. The dead end. It's a dead end. You can see it. And so the future belongs to those who are going to heal it. And that brings people together in a way that was unanticipated, that they didn't know, that sort of softens the hard edges of belief systems that have been, you know, exacerbated by demagogues and populists, you know, and people, you know, who are trying to basically take advantage of people's insecurity and fears and crisis of identity. And so if they think it's bad now, you know, wait till climate amps up. And I think we'll see what people do. It could go either way, Conda.
Yeah.
But I think that what I see in rural areas, what I see in regions, what I see in all sorts of areas is people coming together around fisheries, water, health, economic well-being, you know, just the things that tie them together and that they know that tie them together, but can be shredded in the real politic, you know, but not locally. And when we get local, what unites us is more important than what divides us. And I see the solution to reversing global warming actually as a regional localization effort, as opposed to this is what you can do as an individual, this is what the government could do, should do, or conference of the parties, but never does so far. Yeah. And actually there's this beautiful thing happening between those two that is always it's created by individuals, it's incepted by individuals, it's begun by individuals, but it becomes, you know, one person becomes two people, becomes four, becomes eight, becomes 16. I mean, this is agency, which we all have. And, you know, the dream of every cell is to become two cells. And we're cells. We're a cell in the body.
You know, it's interesting because where I saw surprisingly the most incredible coming together across the whole world was, and what was really surprising is what made it happen was the killing of George Floyd, the murder of that black man in the streets in Minneapolis here in this country. And I think, of course, the context was that everybody was at home, you know, COVID had us at home and quiet and sensitive and not busy out there in the world, caring, just taking care of ourselves. And we were, but this happened in the streets of Minneapolis, and to see the world, Paul.
The world.
Change. The world.
Yeah.
The world.
Marched.
Young, old, black, brown, what, everybody was like, no, life is sacred. No.
Right.
At a time when people were dying of this pandemic, and to see this nonsensical death, it was no. And that gave me more hope than anything that I've seen in probably in my lifetime, to see one thing in a Black American man.
Yeah.
And how it broke people's hearts open.
Yeah, I mean, and the thing is, it wasn't like he's a heroic figure. He's heroic in death, but I mean, not, you know, I mean, he was a good man. He was good to his daughter, you know, he was buying cigarettes. He was so prosaic, you know, what he was doing.
Yeah.
And it's what I mean about what unites us actually is far more important than what divides us, you know. And in climate, you know, the homeschooling we're getting from the planet, I think is going to bring us together. It is bringing us together.
Yeah.
And I think it's going to be the best. It's going to be the place that is the most interesting to be part of, you know, because it is regenerative.
Yeah.
And it creates, and the outcomes are beneficial to people, place, and the future, and children, and, you know, and as opposed to otherwise. And people love to come together. You know, baseball season is almost at the end, and there's big crowds, and people are cheering, and all that sort of stuff.
Yes.
We're social beings. We like to be together. We like to learn together and solve problems together. And I think what regeneration can do in these solutions, and hopefully all the different amazing organizations and people in the world right now, you know, the regenerative movement is the burgeoning movement. This isn't us saying, oh, we think there should be a regeneration movement. No, it's here.
Yeah.
Never seen anything grow so quickly. Many of the people who've been around the environmental movement say the same. Somebody asked me, are you worried about the word being co-opted? And I said, not at all, because it already was co-opted. And that happened really quickly. But I think so wonderful about the word is that you can say, you know, oh, you're sequestering carbon and putting glyphosate in the soil. You're not regenerating. Get out of here.
Right. Right.
So people can see it right away, you know, that it's not, you know, what's BS.
Yeah.
And so I see it as humanity coming together in the face of danger, threat for sure, dislocation, disruption, and so I'm very, what's the word? I feel optimistic about that. The rate it does, and, you know, the pushback it gets from, you know, a very corrupt political system. The oligarchy, we saw basically the Pandora papers published this weekend by the Washington Post about
all that, right?
Leaders, you know, just
very rich people and what they're doing with their money.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I think you're right, Paul. I'm an optimist. Absolutely. I'm actually, you know, one of the things that I'm doing, I think, you know, is I'm working with Black farmers and here, and that's why I moved. I left Oakland to move to Louisiana to help lift them up in some ways. And we're doing regenerative ag, but we don't call it that.
No.
Because it's not what they want to hear. They want to know how they're going to be able to, you know, make it at the end of the year, right? And so, and we're bringing a climate resilient, beautiful way of growing rice to them. And then on the other side, there's another program with Jubilee Justice where we are what we call the journeys, where we bring people together across race and across class. And it is so powerful what's happening in that other part of what I'm doing right now, and seeing people coming together, sitting in spaces that you would, even someone, a Black woman said this in our last, this is all on Zoom, gathering, said, I'm about to say something that I never say in front of white people. I only say with Black people. And she said what she had to say, and we're opening in ways that we have to now. We have to do this work.
Yeah.
We have to have our own spaces. Absolutely. We have to have our and we have to have it together, because this is, and so the work that's happening, and I'm very optimistic as well about that. I know that it's a big lift. 98% of the people have to move quickly. Now we have to really figure that out, and just again, by just jumping and doing. I love the website. I love the punch list. I'm just going to start talking about the website and sending people to the website, to the book, regeneration.org. It is a place of gathering, and it is definitely has so much potential. It has so much potential to be that lever that can change things and make the biggest difference, the biggest difference.
I think one of the things that that is about the website is that it's really a collaborative, and it's a partnership with many other organizations, and they're not all shown yet. I mean, the book came out before the website, so to speak. The website's too. So there's still work by Damon Gamow in Australia, and Clover Hogan at Force of Nature, and John Elkington in London, and the Climate Action Systems with Elon Rosenblatt and Rosamund Zander. We're working with the University of California, Irvine. They become our partner. They are the only university in the world to receive a Nobel Prize for Climate Science. Mario Molina. They started the first earth sciences school in the world. They have the biggest scientific school in North America. They have the most first-gen students in parlance is students who come from families that didn't have any college graduates. They have more first-gen students, and they're highly diverse. I mean, you know, than all the Ivy League schools put together. They're rated number one and two in alternating years by the Sierra Club as the greenest school in the United States. They have 21 LEED platinum buildings. They're turning the campus into a microgrid as a way to model regional generation and distribution of energy, renewable energy. And they're talking about creating the Center for Regeneration, which would give it, you know, both on the research side, they're becoming a partner to us. There's another, there's another collaboration that's coming to us that will, I think, make so when you go there, it's not like, okay, it's us, we have these firewalls, you know, and you can't go anywhere else, and there's hyperlinks. What we're trying to do is is architect it so a way that you can go in and out of other websites and apps and things and come and go, so that we erase that that thing. Like, you know, we all do it. It is our websites. You know, it's like it's walled. And then as NGOs, we get funded, you know, according to how we're different than other ones. You know, why are we better? I mean, no one does this. We're unique.
Right.
We are going towards the opposite, which is shared, collaborative. Some of the media, some of the video stuff that's coming will very, very much be about that. We're talking about a six-part series, docu-series. I don't know if it will happen, but I'm going to invoke her name anyway. But so the producers are talking to Amanda Gorman, you know, as narrator. What I said to this is a famous company that is, you know, who does amazing work in terms of movies and television. And what I said to them, if we have another climate trope documentary, it's like, you know, if we don't look at this with new eyes, it's completely different. And if you don't want to watch this, if you don't really understand climate, but you can't turn it off and you want to binge watch it, we know we're on the right track.
Beautiful.
Make it open. People can see, and this sounds narcissistic, it's not. People can understand their self-interest in it, you know? Mm-hmm. And say, you know, that this is how I benefit and how I become a better mother or father or uncle or aunt or, you know, what pastor or, you know, imam or whatever, you know, this is the opening. And to see climate and see the crisis, to see global warming as an opening rather than a curse, as an offer instead of a take, is really the heart of regeneration. And the fact of the matter is that for years, decades, we've been told that if we go towards addressing global warming, we're going to screw ourselves up economically. Well, we are screwing ourselves up economically right now because all the money is being concentrated in a tiny, tiny few hands in the world. Right. And the fact is, regeneration does the opposite. It creates meaningful living wage jobs to give people purpose and dignity.
Purpose. Yeah. Yep. Yeah.
Because so many jobs are out there. You make your $15, $20 an hour, but I mean, end of the day, you don't feel like it had any meaning. And the number one cause of depression is lack of purpose.
Yeah, that's it. It's still that separation. It builds into the separation
of
purpose. Yeah.
If bringing the world back to life doesn't give you a sense of meaning in your life and for your family and respect. And
that's right.
I don't know what will.
Right. That's right. I think that I agree with everything you're saying, Paul. I think that that's the key. That is the key. And we have what we need.
You really do.
Yeah, we have it. I'm so grateful for this, you know, you in general, you know that. And you've always been just on the leading edge of a better world, a better beings, better world. And this latest work has, I loved Drawdown. And as you know, I loved it. And now this is just another layer, just another layer. And it's what we need right now. I just want to spread it wide. And if people can just get even a little bit of it, what regeneration is and how they already have it and how they already are of it. And just putting life at the center of everything we do and decisions we make, just that, if they just hear that, don't read the whole book, you know, just know that and think, okay, everything that I do, every decision that I make, put life at the center of it. Okay. First of all, it's presence. You're asking for presence. You're saying, be aware, stop and look and be aware and observe, because we just do things, you know, next thing I know, I'm on Amazon or whatever you are on that you buy stuff. And it's like, no, it's like, be aware first, stop and have presence and then make decisions that center life. And when you do that, all of these ramifications, all of these things that we are trying to change, become apparent that they're connected to our choices. They're connected to not centering life. They're connected to not centering life. And it's as you said, it's who we are. It's who we are as beings on the planet. We center life. I love what was it that I love Lila June's, what she said in her part in it. She talked about what was it called? I wrote it down. I don't have it in front of me. The kinds of beings that create habitat for other beings.
Yeah. She said,
what was it?
The first time I'd ever read it, actually, but she talked about the indigenous cultures that had populated that whole belt of Tennessee, Kentucky, and the whole eastern lands there, which were so biodiverse and rich and fecund,
All right. Keystone species.
I was going to tell you. Yeah. She described, the first time I ever heard a human described as humans as keystone species. And keystone species are species that in the way they live their life, they create more life for others. And so bees and hummingbirds are keystone species. So are wolves, so are beavers. There's many different types of keystone species, but observably, you know, what they do actually creates the conditions for more life. And actually that's what life does, period. Life creates the conditions for more life. And I thought her essay at the Forester's Farm is beautiful because it really chronicled, you know, what she's studying. She's getting her PhD in pre-Columbian food systems. And the idea, again, the projection from, let's be honest, starving Europeans who came to America who were not doing well with respect to food, has projected ever since onto the Native Americans who are here that somehow they were living a hardscrabble existence and barely able to feed themselves is absolutely, again, completely false and upside down and backwards and so forth. Probably one of the most sophisticated food systems in the world, all the way down through Mesoamerica and South America. I mean, astonishing agronomists and plant understanding and so forth. But I feel like you started this thing talking about dairy products and that basically when you discovered through Arnold Arendt's work, you know, that if you didn't eat a dairy product, okay, you could breathe and you didn't have stomach cramps. Okay. So that is basically a system on the Mason's body giving feedback, right?
Right.
And then when you address the feedback, life got better.
Right.
Global warming is the planet, it's a system, it's giving us feedback. The feedback you got from your body was a blessing, not a curse. It was again, an opening. It was actually a tell. It was a suggestion. It was like, listen up, whatever. And the same thing is happening to us in the entirety of our system, this beautiful planet that we live upon and within. And so it's giving us feedback.
Yeah.
And feedback is actually, it's an opening. That's what I was trying to say. It's like, it's a gift.
Yeah.
And I don't mean that somehow those who have and are suffering, you know, from the past changes in extreme weather, you know, are a gift. That's not a gift to them, but it's a gift to us in our terms of our awareness of what we could become.
Yeah. And
this is a basically an inflection point, or it's not. I believe it is.
Yeah, it absolutely is. So interesting. I think about those last words of, you know, besides calling for his mother, you know, I can't breathe. And I was saying, I can't breathe. You with I can't breathe.
Yeah.
And I think the earth is saying, I can't breathe.
Yeah.
I can't breathe. And so breath is life and we got to center it. We have to center it. I'm so pleased to have this time with you, Paul.
Thank you so much. We could talk all day.
I know.
We talked for an hour before.
So much more, but it's just so good to have you and to, you know, just always count on you. I do. I count on you. I do. I think what would Paul think? What would Paul do? You're a barometer for me personally. And it's hard because God is such a high bar. Sometimes I think, oh God, just get him out of my mind. Can I just do this thing? You know, but it's like,
I don't want to be that kind of bar.
But it's a good thing. Ultimately, it's a good thing. And I just pray for us all.
Thank you so much.
We can all do this thing called life together, happily, joyfully.
Thank you for what you're doing, I know what you're doing. I mean, you've described it to me before. It's amazing. And that's it.
Yeah.
That is it. And everyone, you found your it to do, you know, And you're learning from it, and it's growing, and it's transformative. And there's 7.8 billion of us, you know. And whether you're children or whether you're a senior citizen, everything in between, we all can find our it. We can all find a way to change, to transform, to move towards regeneration. And it is such a cool thing to do. And as I said, it doesn't make us economically insecure. Where we're going is making us very economically insecure.
Thank you, Paul.
Thank you, Kanda.
All right. See you around town.
Absolutely.
Bye-bye.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. What would you like to get off your chest? Are you holding on to secrets, fears, or frustrations? We all carry around different stressors, both big and small. Don't keep it all bottled up inside. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest and work through whatever is weighing you down. It's also a great way to learn to resolve conflict, change negative thought patterns, and more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/beherenow today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com/beherenow.